Welcome into this special edition of Shark and the Dog. For years, we have just broken down what has gone on in the last few weeks of the Boston sports world and the sports world in general. This time, we are doing our first ever documentary review as the gang reviews the recent Apple TV series, The Dynasty, which was a 10-part documentary series about the New England Patriots dynasty from the years 2001 until 2020. And Dave, it was a 10-part, 10-episode series. And when I was watching it, I felt like there was so much to cover that it could have been a 20 or 30-part documentary series. But I think they did as well as they could, packing it in to 10 episodes while fitting a narrative that was questionable at times, and we will definitely get to. But the structure of this episode is going to be, we are going to go show by show, episode by episode, where I read the description, and then we just talk about what happened in that episode. If you haven't seen the documentary series, I even think you could listen to what we're going to say and still watch the show after, as almost like a primer. If you've already seen it, I'm sure you'll agree with every single thing we've said, just like every other episode we have of this show. But first, to my right is the shark himself, Mr. Dave Nardella. Dave, how are you?
I'm good, John. It's good to be kind of a storyteller tonight.
Yeah, very much so. Storyteller, and unfortunately, without the dog father, nothing personal. He just is not going to watch the series, so we're going to leave him out. And it's a bit of a 10th anniversary episode of this is right around the time when Matthew Kovach made his first appearance on the show back in the spring of 2014, when it was two speakerphones hovering over in an iMac. So in the great state of California is Mr. Matthew Kovach with us. Matt, how are you?
These are the days of our lives. It's really crazy to be on the other side of the dynasty when over the last, call it 10 years of the dynasty, you felt like, I think that somewhere around 2012, people looked around and said, wow, we're going through something incredibly historic that you'll never see again. And it's just crazy to kind of be on the other side of, you know, the yellow rainbow.
Very well said. Let's get right into it. Dave, I'm going to read the description of the first episode. Episode 1, Backup Plan. After Drew Bledsoe suffers a devastating injury, Robert Kraft and Bill Belichick put the hopes of the franchise in sixth-round draft pick Tom Brady. Dave, start us off.
Sure. I think, you know, that synopsis is great, but it really starts off as going through when Kraft bought the team and how he was the local savior. And really, you could really show, you know, when you watch the whole season, you can really, like, look back on that episode and be like, ah, I see what they're kind of doing here right away. They're showing this is a Kraft production. And they go through that. They don't go through any of the Parcells seasons to get them set up for that, you know, that 0-1 season.
I mean, barely.
Barely. They mentioned it, but nothing crazy. And you know, it was it went through in detail of the Bledsoe injury, which was, I didn't realize, I knew it was bad, but like the whole when they had the doctor on from MGH and explaining what could have happened, you know, potentially death, it was pretty scary. And you know, Kraft was kind of put in a dilemma because, you know, that this was his golden boy's first overall pick, you know, let him do a Super Bowl. Brady comes in, you know, they go through the season and Brady's kind of struggling. Should he come back in? And that was the kind of first, do I trust Bill in this moment here? He did it with Bernie Kosar. It failed, kept Brady in, and, you know, they go through the episode and they get that Super Bowl. So it's pretty crazy. It's a whirlwind of an episode, like essentially 15 years packed into one.
Yeah. I mean, they pack a lot of history into this one. And for the people who haven't seen it, this episode ends with the lead up to the regular season Rams game. So they try and tell the story of the Patriots being a shit franchise, Robert Kraft saving the franchise in many ways. Is it, you know, overdone at times? Sure. But if you were to ask, did he save the Patriots? 100%. So they have to touch on a Super Bowl appearance. They don't even talk about Pete Carroll.
No.
And so they miss that part, which isn't a huge part of Patriots history, but it's something. And then they have to get into what's going on with Bledsoe, what Bledsoe means to this team, and then launch into the starting of the Tom Brady legacy leading up to that tough decision for Belichick going into the Rams game when Bledsoe is essentially at full health, which you'll see in the episode. Cove, start us off here.
Yeah, there's nothing about the move to Connecticut. And mm-hmm. and again, what people have to realize is that this book is, or this doc, this doc, the Dynasty, the documentary series, is an adaptation of a book written by Jeff Benedict. So there is, you know, to be fair, and certainly there's a lot of people who beat up on the documentary. To be fair, you should read the book because there is more, even pre-Bledsoe history laid out in the book. But as far as the documentary is concerned, not talking about the team's potential move, A to St. Louis and B to Hartford, is extremely negligent. And, you know, obviously, I hope this is not blasphemous on the Holy Week, but when you talk about the Patriots, it always has to be A, B, and BB, before Brady and after Brady. But before Brady, call it, you know, in September 1st, 2001, the Patriots, only 5-6 years earlier, very, very recent, almost moved to St. Louis. It was a toss-up between the Rams and the Patriots, and James Orthwine was from St. Louis, who had bought the team with the express consent of moving the team to St. Louis. And then obviously, you can go back. I'm sure you can find it somewhere online. A big photo of the Hartford Courant with Bob Kraft on the cover is, you know, the savior, the king of Connecticut. So not putting that stuff in the documentary when you're doing a big lead up to, you know, again, who the Patriots were before the 2001 season is a little negligent because those stories were colossal. One thing too is in the lead up to the Rams game, and I think it's very important, and I'm sorry, I'm not trying to, you know, take a red pen to Dave's paper here. Brady was not struggling. Brady was playing very well. Mm-hmm. Before the Rams game, Belichick made a big mistake, and he even said this, he said it countless times, that he split the reps between Brady and Belichick, and he feels like that was one of the reasons they lost that regular season Rams game. But, I think Bledsoe was phenomenal, and he comes off real well in the first episode. I like how he even jokes with the narrator about, you know, he's in the zone, and they talk about, like, Michael Jordan. He goes, yeah, me and Michael Jordan kind of thing. And that shows you what kind of guy Drew is, very stoic but also affable too. So, Bledsoe covers himself in glory. He's awesome. He's awesome in the first episode. And I think that the other thing that people have to remember when they're thinking about Bledsoe and they're seeing him in the documentary there, that was Belichick was Bledsoe's third coach in 5 years. He was his third coach in 5 years. Charlie Weiss was the third third offensive coordinator. And when you saw Bledsoe at that point, you saw a guy who'd been like, you know, he'd gone through like an RCI training to become Catholic and then went into, you know, like studied the Torah to become Jewish and then started studying like Buddhism. And you have all these religions that are kind of contradicting each other in their head. And that's why you saw Bledsoe, you know, I think really regress and struggle to the point where they thought Brady was the better quarterback, even in camp leading up to that season. But you just couldn't bench, you know, Drew Bledsoe. It would have been like benching Nomar Garciaparra.
I like it. I was saying to Cove off air before the episode of, I thought Bledsoe came off great in this of, he handled it about as well as you could, because there isn't much more of a vote of confidence from a team than giving someone $100 million contract in 2000 or 2001, whenever that contract came about. and then you think it's your job, and this guy from, you know, Michigan, who's a sixth round pick, takes your job, wins a couple of games, and you in your mind just recently brought this team to a Super Bowl. You would otherwise think that the second you come back from your life-threatening injury that it's your team again. And Belichick makes such a tough decision, and the decision he makes wraps up what is so great about him and what probably clouded his judgment at times of making huge, like, team swinging decisions like that in a cold fashion. So I thought that was pretty impressive. What was the other thing from the episode that I wanted to cover, Dave? I'll just hop it to you until it comes back to me.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was I thought Bledsoe was great in it too. I mean, as you go on in the episodes, you know, you see the Super Bowl and kind of what leads up to that. You could tell he's really frustrated, but he handled it as well as he could. And you know, it's that I don't know, for we segueing into episode two.
No, I got one last question on this. Yeah. So the end of episode one is in, and this is where we find out what the documentary is going to kind of be like, because Kraft says no idea how difficult of a decision we had to make. And it just goes to show you, like, the way he views his role in the team and revisionist history, how much he may have thought that he had a role and a stake in making a coaching decision like that of who's going to start a game at quarterback. And so there's a little bit of Kraft delusion that we will definitely touch on in the rest of the recap episode. And one thing that came up, Dave, and Cove, you were older than us. We were, you know, what, Dave, 9 and 10 years old when this happened. But I still remember there was a feeling around this team and what Brady was doing that even if Bledsoe comes back healthy, you got to stick with Brady. And I firmly remember being so pro Brady because when they beat up on the Colts and won a couple games that just looked different. And there was a different vibe around the team. And so that was my thought process. Kraft makes it out to seem like the whole and there's some stuff from the media, like Colin, there's a Collinsworth clip and a few things that make it seem like all of New England was like, you got to put Bledsoe back in. I think it was more like 80-20, maybe even 90-10.
Just that, but Cove probably remembers best, but
Dave's in agreement with me. Cove, you as the older gentleman,
I would say that was 65-35, 60-40, because Brady was such an unknown quantity. And Drew Bledsoe, there were two schools of thought. Number one, people thought of him the way people in Detroit thought about Matthew Stafford. Oh, my God, they never put a team around him. He's so bad. He would have been so great if they would have done this, this, and that, given him some stability. Then there's the converse, kind of like where Paul Pierce was in 2004 or 5, call it 6, where he told Jackie McMullen he was destined to be a great player on a bad team, and Paul Pierce got the blame for anything bad that happened to the Celtics, you know, in that early 2000s. So that was kind of where the Bledsoe narrative was. Either you felt bad for him because you thought he was a prodigy that was saddled with losers, or you thought he, you know, was terrible and he was the reason that the franchise had regressed after Parcells. I think this has to be said right now. You know, none of us know Bob Kraft, and none of us should pretend to know Bob Kraft. But I will tell you this: I would put my next 6 paychecks on the fact that if it was up to him, he would have started Drew Bledsoe when Bledsoe was medically cleared to play. Yep. I promise.
Yeah, I think he even alludes to that.
Yeah,
he calls him.
Sorry to cut you off, but he calls him, you know, like a son when he gave him that contract. You know, you could tell.
He also calls Tom Brady and Aaron Hernandez.
Yes.
A son.
Yeah, true.
And we'll get into
that,
both those.
You know, I mean, that was his golden boy. Gave him $100 million.
Okay.
All right. Good.
So quick to find some other son.
All right. That's a good segue into episode 2, The Snowball. Bill Belichick shocks the world by doubling down on Tom Brady. An icy showdown with the Oakland Raiders redefines what's possible for the Patriots. So this summary makes it seem like they only focus on the Raiders, right. But the episode starts with the highlights of that Rams game, and the narrative around that game was you were playing the greatest show on turf. They were an absolute juggernaut. They were like, for what we went up dealt with as sports fans up to that point, Dave, they were the biggest like juggernaut. Other than like some of those early 2000s, late 90s Yankees teams of like, there's no chance if you can, yeah, the early Lakers, like when Pierce beat Shaq's Lakers and things like that. If you could even, you know, sniff a win, you had a shot as a team. So they focus that entire game on Brady's performance. When I remember coming out of that game feeling so positive that we could hang with a team. I know Brady made mistakes, and they kind of just tie that into the Bledsoe Brady thing so much. But that did feel like, even though it broke up a win streak for us, it felt like a huge turning point.
Yeah, no, 100%. It was that game. I felt the same way. I mean, my memory of that season are I remember getting the Super Bowl DVD and watching it over and over and over. And
VHS, Dave. Yep. It was not a DVD.
Yeah. And, you know, that game specifically, they kind of, you know, they got through the other games. They focused on the Colts game where that was kind of Brady's coming out party. And then it was that game where, you know, they're showing all the warm-ups, everything. It was a huge game. In New England and in the NFL, it was probably one of the bigger games of the season. And Brady, you know, they focused on kind of the bad parts of Brady, which, you know, as a director makes sense, kind of, you know, make some drama. Did they bring back Bledsoe and whatnot? But I thought what was great was it was really the introduction to Ernie Adams. Mm-hmm. And he made the when Bledsoe came back from the injury, or that, you know, that year, they kind of noticed it was like a wildebeest. That wildebeest comparison is like one thing that sticks out in my mind from that episode where, you know, he compared Bledsoe to a wildebeest, you know, trying to escape, you know, the prey, and he just got slower. His mechanics weren't as good. You know, he couldn't throw the ball downfield as well, afraid to get hit. And it was like kind of the first time where you're like, all right, Ernie's really, really the brains behind all this, and Belichick will listen to him. And thank God they did, because they kept Brady in, and, you know, obviously the rest is history. But that was that's kind of what I remember from that episode. It was just the Ernie Adams intro and how great of a character he is.
And he stays the same throughout every single episode.
He's ride or die.
He's a top five interview, and we will get into some of our favorite interviewees in across the episodes. Cove, you had a more developed brain when this game happened. What were your thoughts coming out of that regular season in Foxborough, lost to the Rams?
Well, the regular season Rams game was a big game. It was a Sunday night football game with Mike Patrick and Joe Theismann and Paul McGuire on ESPN. And I do remember that one of the biggest plays in the game was made by Dave's brother-in-law, Terrell Buckley, who had a 52-yard interception in the game. I mean, obviously that was before Dave married into the family, but Terrell Buckley had a pick in that game. I think Teddy Bruschi had a pick in that game, and that was a 24-17 game. So it's very, very, very close game. And first of all, people came away from that realizing, wow, at the very least, no matter who the quarterback is going to be, the Patriots under Belichick are going to be tough. Because, again, at that time, the Rams, and this is not when every offense could look like this in the NFL, that was when you were allowed to just basically do kind of a no more layups on the receivers for the other team. And, you know, if you didn't like the fact that, you know, Isaac Bruce was floating around the middle of the field, you could level him and, you know, make him think twice about going back there again. I don't think people understand, for maybe some younger fans on the show, Kurt Warner in 2001 was everything you've seen from Pat Mahomes over the last 7 years. But one thing, because I think it was so important after that, after the Rams game was the game that followed the Rams game. And that was a demolition of New Orleans a week later. And this was one of the things that was not in the dynasty. That was just a bummer because, Belichick says this a bunch. He goes, listen, I screwed up the Rams game. from a defensive standpoint, but number two, I was splitting the reps in practice between Brady and Belichick. It was a mistake. All this, you know, and it's very hard for, you know, one quarterback to, you know, prepare to start the game if he's splitting the starters' reps. Not rocket science for our listeners. But the next week, they knew that Brady was going to be the starter, but Belichick said, that's it. They went out, they played New Orleans, and they crushed New Orleans, like 34-17 in Foxborough. I think statistically, it's Brady's best game of the 2001 season. So that really showed, you know, number one, the gravitas that it took for Belichick to make the decision, but number two, how affirming it was, because when he settled on his guy, you know, the rest is history.
Cove, we got to keep it moving. We're still on episode two recap, and we haven't even gotten to the meat of episode two, which is the snowball. So we lose to the Rams, and spoiler alert, the Patriots win every single game the rest of the way in the 2001 season. And they get through the regular season, and then they get a home game to host the Raiders coming in there. And I think they frame it in the episode like the Patriots were underdogs. I think, you know, in theory, there's a little bit of an underdog mentality. But from a, I bet if you went back and looked at, like, the actual odds, they were probably the favorite.
No, I don't think so.
With the weather element and just where those teams were from a record standpoint, Dave's going to look it up historically, but that is something that they, I think they kind of blow up a little bit, but nevertheless, the meaning of that game and the gravity behind that game was so massive. And then what unfolds in it is NFL history of it's literally a play call away from this docuseries, maybe any of these Super Bowls even happening. So there's so much to break down here. I think if you're going to take anything away, it's the first real game on the line, you know, Tom being Tom. And it's just, it cements who Adam Vinatieri is. It's his most, he had two game-winning Super Bowl game-winning field goals, and in my mind, they barely touch what he did in that snowball game. So those are two of the big things that stick out to me. And then just the bit parts of Wiggins, Redmond, Troy Brown, all these, you know, what made up such a powerful roster is on display in this game. Dave, thoughts on the snowball?
Yeah, I mean, you got to think of that Raiders team, too. They had some legends on that team. You know, Tim Brown, Jerry Rice, Gruden, Rich Gannon. It was an incredible, Charles Woodson. They had an incredible team. I looked up the line, John. We were 3-point favorites, and I'm sure part of that at the time was the weather, you know, with the snow and everything. But that, you know, you got to think back. I mean, the 45 yard field goal in that weather is unbelievable. But I just remember the catches that Troy Brown had, Jermaine Wiggins on the sideline. There was just some epic plays. Brady rushing into the end zone, the spike, when you kind of knew, like, all right, we're kind of back in this game, because it did not look good for most of that game. And then we get
saved by one of the stupidest rules in NFL history.
Tuck rule. But, I mean, in the documentary, they're all like, that was the rule. It was the rule. So, I mean, you know, you could say all you want, and I'm sure John Gruden to this day, you know, will tell you his mind about it. But, I mean, it was the rule, and it was the birth of the Brady comebacks, and you just knew they were never out. And, you know, it, like I said, I just remember as a kid, my memory from that was, like, you know, Jermaine Wiggins, the local guy, getting all these, like, sideline catches, clutch. And that's one thing. I wish he was in the documentary, because he's a good personality and he's a Boston guy. But it was that game was truly incredible.
Here's the thing, Dave. We'll get into this. Maybe they did interview him, maybe, and it didn't fit their narrative of, which we will get into, of Robert Kraft good, Bill Belichick bad. Yeah. That could very well be the case, that it didn't fit that.
I don't think you can undermine how good that Raiders team was, too. It's just a team full of legends, and it was your first real win. And then you have to go into the Steelers, which we'll get into.
So. They were one of the last real good, scary Raider teams. Yeah. Like, they were Raiders through and through.
The next year, they went to the Super Bowl, right? Next year?
Yes, they were. They lost the Super Bowl.
Was that the Bucks?
The Bucks.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
They lost to Gruden in the Bucks.
Yeah, that's very true. Forgot about that. Cove, first question. Where did you watch the snowball?
Scary. I was visiting my mom in Cleveland, and that next Monday I was going to drive back to UMD. So it was a winter break, and our winter breaks at UMD were a little longer. So I was still visiting my mom in Cleveland, and I went with my great friend Kevin Morgan, who I bullied into becoming a Patriots fan at the end of the season. Because his dad actually played for the Patriots when Gino Cappelletti was on the team. So I'm like, come on, you can't go against the Pats. You can't go against your dad. We went out to a bar called Scorchers, and I promise you, if I got picked up for DUI that night, I would have just gotten out of jail five minutes before the episode. We can laugh about it now, but it was obscenely irresponsible coming from somebody who works at a personal injury law firm. It was obscenely irresponsible how much I drank and the fact that I drove and the fact that we went to three other bars after the game. And I'm just driving around probably just high on life and, you know, Rolling Rocks. I can't wait to reveal my watch destinations for the AFC Championship game that year, the Super Bowl and Super Bowl 38, because the watch destinations are just absolutely incredible. Real quickly, the reason Jermaine Wiggins would have been the ultimate interview is because he was on the Patriots in Super Bowl 36, and then 2 years later, he was on the Panthers and played against the Patriots in Super Bowl 38. But just a couple quick hits on the snowball. My favorite ever is the fact how Gruden and everybody bemoans the rules. Nobody remembers John Gruden calling a timeout before the big Vinatieri kick. And Vinatieri looks up and goes, oh, my God, he just called timeout. So we're going to clear a path. And, I mean, it was just crazy. It was that Gruden called the timeout that the Seahawks were hoping that Belichick would call in the end of Super Bowl 49. One other thing, I love lineage, and I love, you know, when you say that, you know, this person was with that person. Think about this. Jerry Rice played in the Snow Bowl. He was the MVP of Super Bowl 23. 30 years later, the opposing quarterback, Tom Brady, won Super Bowl 53. And 2 years before, he was the MVP in 51. But that's pretty incredible to know that Snow Bowl game is such a line of demarcation in NFL history where Jerry Rice played. He was still very good, and he was the Super Bowl MVP, Super Bowl 23, and then, you know, Brady wins the Super Bowl 30 years later, Super Bowl 53. Pretty incredible when you think about that. One of the other things I love.
30 years?
30 years, Super Bowl 23 to 53. So in Super Bowl 23, I'm just saying, Rice played in that game. He was the Super Bowl 23 MVP. He was still obviously, you know, I wouldn't say the height of his powers, but he was still very good. And he was in that game, and that just shows you how long Brady lasted, how long the dynasty was. I think that's one of my favorite stats, actually. You know, Brady grew up loving Montana and Rice, and here he's in his biggest game of his life against Jerry Rice. My other favorite thing about the snowball is, and it's probably, call it top three images of the dynasty, is when Brady does the spike and he falls over in the end zone. He spikes the ball and falls over, and I love Gino Cappelletti's call, and he talks about Brady, and he goes, on his first run of the night! it just sticks in my mind, and, you know, always will. I will say this, too. If it wasn't such a blizzard, I think the Raiders were a wild card team that year. They beat the Jets at home, but if it wasn't such a blizzard, I think it would have been a pick-em, or the Raiders might have even been a road favorite, because people still did not believe, and again, I don't want to get too far down the line, but Belichick had his famous line after Super Bowl 36. He goes, if there's a game next week, we'll be there, and I'm sure we'll be the underdogs.
Unbelievable. I love it. One other thing, it's the last game in Sullivan Stadium.
Yep.
Of what an amazing final game at that shithole before the new empire is built. There's plenty more we could talk about the snowball, but we got to switch gears here and head right into episode three. I'll read it here. Episode is called borrowed time. In the wake of 9/11, the Patriots emerge on football's biggest stage and face pressure that could unite them or tear them apart. And so, Dave, this basically covers a lot. It does start in kind of describing how that season starts, how much 9/11 impacted the NFL world, the sports world, and how amazing it was that the Patriots were the team that goes on this epic run throughout that season. And in the episode, they also mainly touch on the AFC Championship game and what goes on there, and then leading up to the Super Bowl. So I'd say of what they cover in this episode with those three items is that's jamming 20 pounds of shit into a 5-pound bag in a great way. That is an action-packed episode, and it's kind of the last of like the darling episodes of this series before it gets really negative. So thoughts on this one,
Dave? Oh, I think it's one of the best just because they go through, you know, obviously the Pittsburgh game. They were actually, when I was looking up the line for the Oakland game, they were going into that game huge underdogs. You know, they were, I think, opened up at like 11-point underdogs going in. I mean, that Steelers team was unbelievable too. And, you know, it just kind of showed it really was the first episode where they really got into the do your job culture. And it was kind of the creation of that dynasty culture. And, you know, everyone do your job and we'll be fine. And that team really stuck with it. And, you know, I know I'm kind of going past the Steelers game, but my favorite part of that episode, obviously, they do the Bledsoe, you know, is Bledsoe going to play type of thing. But when they arrive in New Orleans and they, you know, they're staying in a shitty hotel, lack of a better term, and Lawyer Malloy's pissed and Belichick's, you know, like, Lawyer, you want my room? Like, it was just kind of like a good humor in that episode because it was probably, you know, super tense at that time. They were huge underdogs, but I just loved that part of it where, you know, Belichick's like, you know, Lawyer, you can take my room if you want. And it was kind of just like, you know, we're the underdogs. We're going against the prime, you know, the one of the best teams of that era. And, you know, we're going to do our job and we're going to win. And that was kind of the creation of the Belichick culture, which is why I think this episode is just incredible. There's so many little things that, you know, reveal how great that team was. Coming out as a team, being announced as a team in the Super Bowl, you know, the whole kind of Brady Bledsoe drama leading up to it, how Bledsoe kind of helped, you know, he was, you could tell he was really upset about it. And it was just a great episode.
He gets him there. The one thing that there are so many things that get left out of this, but the play where Troy Brown chases that guy down and gets the ball back is that's the game.
Yeah.
Right there. If he doesn't do that, it goes the other way. One thing that one sec, Matt, I do have to just mention this one thing I absolutely loved. I don't know if this was like a hidden footage thing or if Matt saw it back in the day and I just absolutely missed it. What Brian Cox is saying to Jerome Bettis before the game is frightening. It is so good. I don't know if that was in the archives and they just, you know, threw that in there. But that was amazing. Also, the Celtics are down 2 after they were up 30. They're about to blow a game with 1 second left to the Atlanta Hawks. So thank God we're talking about this and not that. Cove, go ahead on the Steelers game.
Yeah, I've got this on in the background. It's nauseating. Any game in Atlanta makes me nauseous. So the Steelers game, you could be totally crazy here and say that the Steelers upset in Pittsburgh may have even been bigger than the Super Bowl 36 upset. But that Pittsburgh team was excellent. I mean, this is, you know, Bill Cowher at the height of his coaching fame. Not only did they have Jerome Bettis, they had Amos Zerway, who was also a really good running back. I mean, there was kind of like a thunder and lightning, you know, the bus. And then Amos Zerway was kind of like a power speedster, a little bit like a Ramondre Stevenson for current Pats fans. And Cordell was just, you know, was otherworldly at that time. And their defense was so incredible. Brian Cox is, you know, obviously didn't play. I think, I forget what game he got hurt in, but Brian Cox didn't play a lot. I mean, he levels Jerome Paython in that Colts game. Brady's first start, but he was so important, and that was part of that when Belichick put up those signs in camp that year that said winners wanted, and Brian Cox was such an important part of that, and he played in the AFC East forever. He was on some old Dolphins teams with Marino, then he was on the Jets, and Belichick knew him, and he was just kind of a you know, kind of like Terrell Buckley, too, just these winners, badass, old-time ballers that were going to really teach a way, teach a culture of winning to, you know, a team that, you know, was otherwise. So, yes, that, I mean, I've seen that footage, you know, prior to the dynasty, and it's amazing. That was, you know, one of the best pieces of that kind of hidden footage that you don't see all the time. That's not going to be in an NFL Films recap of the 2001 AFC Championship game. The big thing is, and this just kind of happens sometimes when you look at sports historically, but, I mean, again, everybody knows that the touchdown from Bledsoe to David Patton, it's beautiful. That game got incredibly close in the second half. And, you know, Lawyer Malloy and friends really had to bite down hard in the fourth quarter. You know, absolutely ridiculous. But the most amazing part in that whole game was Troy Brown's punt return for a touchdown for me. Because Troy Brown is really the secret MVP in 2001. And the fact that he returned a punt for a touchdown in the AFC Championship game, goes into the end zone virtually untouched. Troy's the secret MVP of that team that year. He is. He made the Pro Bowl, obviously. And then, you know, what can you say about down in the Big Easy? What can you say about Super Bowl 36? I will say, the great Michael Holly wrote in the Globe, I will be there on Sunday night to witness the Super Bowl upset. Michael Holly, to my knowledge, was the only person to pick the Patriots.
I was in the fourth grade at the time. I was in charge of sports trivia for the class. I stood up in front of the entire class and told them that the Patriots were going to lose to the St. Louis Rams because they were, and I got booed in my class. And I was glad to be incorrect at that statement. So let's go right in to Super Bowl 36. So much has happened this season, and after seeming like they may not get back to the Super Bowl, and they lost that Super Bowl to the Packers 6-7 years prior by 2 scores. You could point to a couple things in the game that would have made a difference, not kicking it off to one of the best returners. Maybe things would have gone a little bit differently, but you lost to Brett Favre's Packers and you weren't as special. Now you're back there and you're playing the greatest show on turf, who you've already lost to this season, and they're just ripping through teams, and they've just recently won the Super Bowl within the last 700 days. So this is a special, special team that you're going up against. But what, you know, you see the fire in Brady before the game. They come out as a team, which is like, I believe they're saying they're one of like the first teams to do that in that era of like announcing player by player. They come out as a team. He's losing his mind when he's banging his helmet against Drew Bledsoe. They don't even mention this in the documentary. He breaks Drew Bledsoe's front tooth. He's out of his mind. And then that team was just built of absolute killers. The fact that we had a 2-score lead to start that game is insane. Ty Law sets the absolute tone for that game. Of basic, that pick six was the most, we're in this thing, we're going to be in your face all night. It was so important. And then the best touchdown of the season, in my opinion, is that back corner to David Patton. It's just rest in peace. God rest his soul. Just unbelievable. And then we wither that lead away after being up, what is it, Dave, 17-3?
Yep.
But just an unbelievable performance. Thoughts on that game?
It was incredible. I mean, you touched on most of it. I mean, the picture of Ty Law with his hand up running into the end zone, and that interview, in the documentary where he was like, I was so confused because it was like a throw that you would never expect Kurt Warner to make. It was right to him, and he ran it right back. But that game plan, it was the start of, you know, before that episode, I think Damian Woody, said, like, you know, Belichick brought the team together and said, like, you know, do your job. We're all in this together. You know, there's not one guy in the team that's bigger than anyone else. And again, that's, you know, that's why they were introduced as a team. And that's why that, you know, that game was, you obviously there were some great performers in that game, but it was truly a team effort. And everyone kind of played well in their part. And I love that part of the episode where they bring Mike Martz and he kind of comes in and complains about, you know, they were roughing up our receivers and whatnot. It was just like Belichick's coaching. You just got out coached by Belichick. And at that time, you know, it was different. It was, you know, more, it's not what it is today where you can't touch a receiver. It was, you know, we're going to rough them up at the line. And they had, you know, some unbelievable receivers at Torrey Holt, Isaac Bruce, Ricky Prohl, right? That was the guy who played great in the Super Bowl. And we just shut him down.
Ricky Prohl scored the game time touchdown in Super Bowl 36 and then put him ahead in Super Bowl 38.
He was unbelievable. So, I mean, the secondary was unbelievable. The front seven, the defense, it was incredible. I want to go over the final drive where, you know, John Madden's like, they're probably just going to spike the ball and go in overtime here. And it was, I probably watched that drive 50 times, 100 times since, and it's just a Brady clinic. Troy Brown was excellent. J.R. Redmond, Wiggins with some amazing catches. And then, you know, if Vinatieri's going to hit a 45-yarder in the blizzard snow, he's going to nail one in a dome in New Orleans. And it was just like so quick. It happened so quick, but it is one of the best drives in NFL history in terms of – it was incredible.
Dave, I'm sorry when you're saying this. I love the big slant to Troy Brown, the big play on that drive. And Brady kind of steps up and just slightly wiggles his shoulder to get a little more room, almost reminded you of like a great shooter creating a little bit more space in basketball just to get the shot off. And he steps up and kind of has that shrug and he hits that crossing pattern to Troy Brown. And my favorite thing about Madden on the broadcast is he goes, I'm on record saying I'm against what the Patriots are doing. And then Madden's so funny and so affable. When they start driving the ball, he goes, oh, I kind of like what the Patriots are doing.
It's incredible.
J.R. Redmond.
J.R. Redmond. I got to throw in two quick anecdotes. So I watched the AFC Championship game on whatever the smallest television that Best Buy sold at the time. And the colored dorms at UMass Dartmouth, I lived in green, possibly apropos for many reasons. But I lived in green, and I watched it in the dorms, and I refused. I had so many people, hey, you want to go here? You want to go there? I watched it on a crappy TV in the dorms alone, and I remember it so well. And then Super Bowl 36, I got invited to a big party at the fraternity house. My buddy Tavis Smith was the president of the fraternity, and I was getting ready to go, and about an hour before the game, I'm like, there's no effing way I'm going. And I watched the game at home, same TV, in my room again. Nobody around. I remember it just like it was yesterday. And that kind of started the watching alone in certain big games for the rest of my life, unless I felt like my support system was going to be perfect.
I love it. Where I watched the Snow Bowl game, it was like four families, and we basically gutted it out through the Eagles Super Bowl of all big games. Were those crews, same environment. So I hear you there with sticking with tradition in that early era. I'm trying to think of anything else I wanted to touch on in that Super Bowl. One thing you did mention, Dave, of Mike Martz, that is kind of the introduction, one of the introductions in this docuseries of them sprinkling in a villain.
Yeah.
Of maybe Mike Martz got interviewed for 3 hours and said some great things, but they got a couple of clips that they could have an ominous synth sound in the background and make him seem like a Batman villain type of thing. They do that with him well. They do it really well with Bill Parcells. I'm sure they got plenty of good stuff out of Parcells, but they get a couple of clips of him just talking negatively about Kraft and making it look like he's the bad guy for leaving to the Jets, which in some ways he is, but they're pushing their narrative, and those are the precursors to what they're going to do to Bill in these episodes. Anything else on the Super Bowl run, Cove?
You know, the biggest thing when you look back at Super Bowl 36, and I guess this is a prelude into, you know, obviously the next episode, which, you know, some serious shit. But the fact that they put that narrative out there that somebody taped the Pats walk, that the Pats taped that walkthrough, that loser golf pro Matt Walsh, that, as a sports fan, nothing hurt me more because I never believed that they taped the walkthrough. But the fact that people were putting that out there, that hurt me on a level as if somebody was saying something about one of my very best friends or my family. Like, if somebody said something like so terribly nasty about you guys, it would affect me the way that I felt when there was that rumor going around that we taped the walkthrough. Because again, we've all seen upsets. We've, you know, heard about Miracle on Ice and things like that. We've seen upsets in Boston and comebacks and whatnot. You cannot possibly understand how undermanned the Patriots were compared to the Rams going into that Super Bowl. Nobody picked the Patriots. And that was also in a time where Super Bowls really weren't that good. That was Super Bowl 36, which is crazy because we're on Super Bowl, what, 58 now? That was Super Bowl 36, and Super Bowls weren't really good. There wasn't a lot of drama in the games outside of Super Bowl 25 and the Norwood game and, I guess, Super Bowl 23.
Well, the 34 was good with the Titans coming down to the final play.
34 was good with the Titans, but the inner workings of that game are pretty bad. My point is that it was just such a colossal upset that, you know, even as I sit back here sitting in my kitchen 23 years later, it is just so still unfathomable how they beat that team and really how they held the Rams to 3 points going into the fourth quarter. And then, I mean, obviously, you know, nobody talks about the Tabucky Jones fumble that he ran back 99 yards and it was called back because of the Willie McGinnis holding penalty. I remember yelling, "Bill Buckner, Bill Buckner," in my room. It's unbelievable, and it's so crazy because we've seen so much winning in Boston. There's a reason Super Bowl 36 still stands out over anything and everything that we've ever seen.
What a Super Bowl logo, too, Cove.
Oh yeah, that's before they went all generic on the logos. Oh, of course. And by the way, we'd be remiss if we didn't mention Mike Vrabel, who decked Kurt Warner, which really set up that interception, the pick six to tie lost. So can't forget about Braves.
Absolutely. There was a time when we were planning this episode out that we were thinking about recapping all 10 episodes in one single episode. Yeah. We are now at minute, what is it, Dave, 47? I think for continuity's sake, we're going to call episode one right there, and then we will have a little teaser that we're going to be getting into Spygate with the next episode, and it starts to become very Brady-centric. The episode after that is introducing you to the history of Tom Brady, but this is where we really start getting into the Bill Belichick bad, Tom good, Bob good, and they start to veer off of the team and really focus on the stars. And we will touch on how a lot of the Patriots' former teammates feel about that and how they were portrayed and what audio and parts of their interview got used in this documentary. So this is where it starts to get good. All the fluffy stuff was in episodes 1 through 3. We're going to have very different opinions on episodes 4 through 10. So likely looking at a three-part run here of the first ever docu-series breakdown for Shark and the Dog. Dave, anything else to add?
I don't think so. That was great.
Fun to recap those first three. Those were incredible. It really roped you in for sure. Those first three.
Absolutely, Cove. Anything else to add on episodes 1 through 3?
I think about 38 special, and they sing a line that says, "The first time that made our hearts go crazy," and you just think about that run, and I think that so many people, you know, they closed down the old stadium, they beat the Dolphins, and people feel, okay, this is pretty cool, and, you know, hey, we're in a playoff game, and it's a home playoff game, and it's snowy. We had no idea. We literally had no idea, and it's amazing that first piece of magic does kind of stick with you throughout the 20-year run, because you never thought you were out of it, and you always expected to see a miracle.
Absolutely. Good stuff. We will be back in the next couple of days with part two, breaking down likely episodes 4 through 6 or 4 through 7 of the Dynasty, brought to you by Kraft Dynasty LLC. Gang, thanks for coming on.